Well, happy Monday, y'all. If you're actually watching or listening to this program on a Monday, which is no longer necessary, you can do it anytime you want. It's Bob McCown, it's John Shannon with you.
We have to do it every Monday, though.
Well, we do it on the day of notation. When people watch or listen is of their own free will.
If they're a Sirius XM subscriber, it's at 6 o'clock Eastern.
Yes, that I understand.
Yeah.
Do they replay this program at any time on Sirius?
They better not.
That's been known to happen in the past.
Oh, yes. No, they're good friends up over there. They've done a good job for us.
Baseball chatter today. It is that time of year where if you're a baseball fan, you're almost as engaged around this time of year as you are during the regular season.
Aren't you nervous? I'd be nervous.
I think everybody is like, if you're a real fan, you are a little nervous. Every day you're picking up your phone and looking online. Anybody sign? Anybody sign? Did we get anybody? But you know what happened? And you have winter baseball meetings upcoming. And not that that necessarily means anything, but we're always intrigued by when the rush begins. Now, we have had a bunch of high profile pitchers specifically sign, but there are still a bunch out there. There are, I don't know, five shortstops, high profile shortstops available, maybe more. There's a bunch of things that are going to happen. And as often is the case, usually it's triggered by one or two deals. Mm-hmm. Now, the ones, the Syndergaard, Verlander, Rodriguez signings haven't really triggered too much.
No.
But once the shortstops start to fall, you're going to start seeing some
stuff. Carlos Correa, isn't that the key one? Let's be honest.
Well, he's the guy who's expected to get the most. Yeah. Now, whether he's the first one to go or not, I don't know. And I don't know, at the kind of money that he's looking for, how many teams are really going to be in it? I don't know the answer to that either. Two, maybe three? Yeah. I'd be surprised if it's more than that. Yeah, wouldn't you?
I would, but the Tigers have been the talk of the town on this one for so long. And they have, and let's face it, the Illich family has so much money and they want the Tigers to be good.
Well, I get it, but are you going to hang your hopes on Carlos Correa? I mean, a very, very good player. But baseball at the end of the day is not a one-man show. You know, you can hit, he could hit 400 with 60 home runs and the Tigers would miss the playoffs by 20 games. What's the key? And we're going to address all this stuff. And most specifically from the perspective of the Toronto Blue Jays, but not definitively. J.P. Morosi of MLB Network will join us and we'll talk about this offseason, what has happened and what might happen, and maybe a few things out of the box with Shannon and McCown. We'll be back after these messages. Well, we've seen a few free agent signings in baseball. There's still plenty more to come, but a few of the big names are off the board. John Paul Morosi of MLB joins us to chat about all this stuff. Are we ahead of schedule, behind schedule, in your opinion?
Well, good morning. I think we are ahead of schedule a little bit when you consider where things stand right now with the free agent market, to see a number of price points already being set, if you will. The Eduardo Rodriguez contract with the Tigers, I think, was very instructive of where the multi-year deal could be. And then Noah Syndergaard, the former Blue Jays draft pick, reunited with Perry Manassian, of course, who was around the Blue Jays when he was drafted and developed the early years for him with the Toronto organization. Noah Syndergaard signing with the Los Angeles Angels. Then, of course, Verlander, a shorter-term deal as well. So I think we're starting to see some of the big names start to sign. We have not seen the big-ticket shortstops, if you will, that market sign and solidify yet with Carlos Correa and Marcus Semien and that group. But I think we could see some signings. Of course, we know at the end of the month, understanding the CBA is set to expire on December the 1st. So I would expect a very busy next 10 days or so.
Verlander got, 1 year, $25 million, correct, with Houston?
It was actually 2 years with an opt-out, but in a matter of speaking, yes.
Yeah, I was a little surprised by that. Or do you think the market, nobody offered him 3 years?
I think that what you said, Bob, is correct, that no one offered him 3 years. And again, in general, for someone who didn't throw a pitch in the major leagues in 2021, that's a very strong contract, similar to Syndergaard. For Syndergaard, two innings in 2 years gets him more than $20 million. And then Verlander, again, he barely pitched in 2020, missed all of 2021. He gets 2 years. This, to me, is a demonstration of how the market still will pay for elite talent, even when there is a risk. And I think it's important for all the parties involved in these CBA talks to keep that in mind, that this current CBA is rewarding elite talent, even when there is risk. And I think that has been shown clearly in the Verlander and Syndergaard contracts.
John, you talk about Correa and Semien. In the other sport you love, we tend to see free agents wait for each other. You go first. Are we doing the same thing in baseball?
I think so, among the position players, John. And it's such a unique market this year when you consider the number of elite shortstops. We really have rarely, if ever, seen this caliber of talent available all at the same time. Correa is a true shortstop, gold glove, platinum glove shortstop. Corey Seager, also a shortstop. Trevor Story would like to remain as a shortstop. And then you have two players who have been versatile defensively in Semien and Javier Baez. I do think, John, to your point, there's a little bit of collective thought where you don't want to have that one person sign and be out on an island, so to speak. The other unique thing, you have a number of Scott Boras clients here,
right?
Specifically in the realm of Corey Seager and Marcus Semien. Obviously, there's a lot of information shared among that group in the agency overall. Chris Bryant, also a Boras client. Max Scherzer, also a Boras client. I think that when you consider that amount of information and knowledge being concentrated among Scott Boras's group, it does set up a very unique power dynamic between Boras, his clients, and the MLB clubs.
One of the questions I am inclined to ask at this time of year, you hear all these rumors about teams that are in on this guy or in on that guy. And here in Toronto, we hear that the Blue Jays expressed interest in Syndergaard, Verlander, Rodriguez, and Andrew Heaney, at least. I wonder what that actually means. Does it mean there was sincere interest? Were they just kicking the can? You know, I wonder sometimes if organizations leak this information, not necessarily the Blue Jays, but all organizations leak information to try and appease a fan base to make sure that the fan base thinks, oh, my guys tried to get these guys at least. What do you think about that?
There may be some truth to that, Bob, and I think it's a very fair question. There are varying degrees of interest. I just know in my own career reporting on this, sometimes you say interest and it's true and there's legitimate interest in terms of a check-in or dialogue. And sometimes that interest goes all the way to the extent of making an offer. I would suspect the Jays have at this point in time made some offers to free agent starters. I don't know the exact numbers or years or even which of the people in whom they had interest actually received an offer. I do think there was sincere interest in, for example, Eduardo Rodriguez, and there was probably a legitimate chance that he would have chosen Toronto, but Detroit ultimately went to the years and dollars that were required. Toronto, to me, is a really interesting team to think about and talk about. As we've discussed before, they won one more game than the team that eventually won the World Series. This is a very good baseball team, or at least was one in 2021. But to bring back that same collection of talent will be a challenge and will be very expensive because of the amount of money that Robbie Ray is going to get and Semien. And let's remember, the Jays just spent a ton of money, more than nine figures, to get Jose Berrios signed long-term, which was a great contract. But let's not forget, that did not add a player to their 2022 roster. Correct. Berrios was already on it. And so when you consider where this team is, they still have to replace Ray. They still have to replace Mats. They've made a major commitment to their future, no question about it. It was the right contract for the right player. I love the Berrios deal in every way. But they still have to address the current rotation. I don't think the Jays want to begin 2022 with both Stripling and Nate Pearson in the rotation. They have to get at least one high impact starter. They would like to bring back Ray. There's been interest in Gausman. Will Stroman come back? Hard to say, but I do believe the Blue Jays are heavily involved. And importantly, they have enough prospect depth with Moreno, the way he's played behind the plate, or Elvis Martinez as well. They could make an impact trade for someone like a Luis Castillo in Cincinnati or one of the Marlins arms. So I do think, to your question, Bob, the Jays are involved on basically every pitcher of consequence on some level or another. It just comes down to price and if they're actually comfortable making an offer either in prospects or in financial dollars to sign the free agents.
Do you think it's a done deal that both Ray and Matz are gone?
No, I think it'd be very expensive to bring back both of them. And I would say that both returning would be unlikely, but I believe, John, that it's entirely possible that they find a way to keep one of the two.
Well, we'll get back to that. This mentioning Stroman is an interesting one because one of the features of this team was their cohesiveness, their togetherness, the fact that they seem to all like each other and have, we talked about this all year, they seem to be having more fun than a barrel of monkeys in the dugout all year long. And there's no way I think any of us can know what that actually means on the field, but you have to think that's a good thing. Marcus Stroman may not fit that criteria of being one of those good guys, or am I misreading this? And I'll throw this out to both of you because I'm not 100% sure that he's happy, friendly. Come on, everybody. I think he always impressed me as being more about Marcus Stroman. What do you think?
I've always enjoyed Marcus a lot. And I think he has blended in very, very well with particular teams. I do think at the end of his time in Toronto, we all know there was a rebuild that it appeared to be starting, or at least a retooling. There were those issues of the dynamics of his relationship with Aaron Sanchez that became public. I think that this team has changed a lot. The makeup of this clubhouse has changed a lot. New manager, very different cast. I think that he would probably jive much better with this particular group than he did with the last one when he left. That's, I realize it wasn't that many years ago, but the team has changed a lot.
Almost entirely.
Exactly. In the time that Marcus has been gone. So I would say I would not at all rule out the possibility of Marcus Stroman coming back. Relationships change, people change. Marcus Stroman wants to win. I think he is a very unique personality in a great way. I've always enjoyed my conversations with him. I think he has a lot of respect around the game. He is a competitor. No one has ever watched him pitch and doubted his competitiveness, his want to compete. I think that all of those things have been, for me, very highly rated. So I actually think he's probably a better fit for this particular team in Toronto than he was at the time that he left.
The interesting thing is, I mean, I think everybody can mature too. I mean, let's remember when he was given the keys to the castle in Toronto, he wasn't very old. And you know, when you're in the fourth largest market in North America and you get told you're the best pitcher, it can go to your head. The issue for me is he's still 5'8". you know, and when you look at the success of pitchers these days, and I don't want to make a blanket statement, but when you look at pitchers, 5'8" pitchers don't have long-term success, do they, John?
Sometimes they do, or at least those who are under 6 feet. There's Pedro Martinez is in the Hall of Fame. I don't think Pedro is really actually taller than 6 feet. We could side by side. I certainly when I've spoken with Pedro, I don't think he's that much taller than I am, and I am not a tall person. So I would say this, that Marcus has found a way, and with the advent of analytics, there are pathways for pitchers who are not 6 feet tall to find success. And certainly you look at Marcus in the past, he has been a 200 inning pitcher. And that is a very hard thing to do in this league, no matter if you're 5'8 or 6'8. That's a challenge. So Marcus has done it. I think he has found ways to keep his body in peak conditioning form. And I would not, from where I sit, I would not elect against pursuing a player just based on height. It might figure into your calculus on how you'll afford him, perhaps.
Right.
But I don't think that he is someone that you would at all avoid because of height. It figures into the calculus of what the contract offer might be. But I think he has, there's enough of a body of work there for me, John, that I would feel comfortable pursuing him and having him in my rotation just based on what he's been able to do at the major league level.
Take a guess. What's the number for Marcus Stroman?
I think he could easily get 3 or 4 years times 20 a year. I think that range for him is very, very possible.
It's exactly the number I was going to suggest he would be looking for. And I don't know whether I'd give him that. John, opinion?
I have other issues on my baseball, particularly in my infield right now, that I'd rather spend the money somewhere else. I want Ray and I want Matz back before I would want Stroman. That's me.
Well, let's talk about Ray money. I mean, it's a Cy Young Award winner, but a guy who made what, $10 million last year. He's going to get a huge jump based on one supreme year. His track record in every season before that was very iffy. He jumped at an offer to stay with the Blue Jays for $10 million. There were people who thought the Blue Jays overpaid, given his track record, even though in 2019 he showed signs at the end of the year of being better. But now he's in line to get 25 at least, isn't he, Morosi?
I think that's a range that he can credibly request. Whether he gets it is probably an open question, but I think there's no doubt in my mind that his AAV will start with a 2 and probably be at least 21. And then you can start to work on the actual particulars. You look at where Berrios' money comes in. His free agent years were valued at $20 million a year,
yep,
without the benefit of actually becoming a free agent. So when you look at Ray, I would say he's in the per year basis around the $22 to $23 million range at the very least. And then multiply that times 6 or 7, that's probably your deal. I mean, that's basically, he's probably looking somewhere in the, and I've always said never to do math live on the air, it's somewhere in the $22 to $25 range per year, million dollars, times 6 or 7. And that's basically the range you're looking at. And I think Toronto, guys, has a legitimate chance to keep him. And one of the key reasons why is Pete Walker.
Right.
Bobby Ray, for a long time, struggled to throw strikes. And he found that relationship, that comfort, that consistency of delivery, the strong feedback that Pete Walker will give you. For all of those reasons, Toronto was a very compelling place for Bobby Ray to go back to. He's been comfortable in Toronto, and it's hard for me to put a price tag on what it means when someone has struggled to locate the ball for as long as Robbie Ray did, and then finds that comfort and that freedom of not worrying about where the ball's going anymore. I mean, that is a tremendous, tremendous life and professional comfort that Robbie Ray discovered in Toronto. And he pitched so well once he got to Rogers Center at long last, after all the different travels the Jays had in 2021. I give him an immense amount of credit. I really appreciate and admire what he was able to do. And I think for a lot of reasons, that comfort in Toronto with Pete Walker will loom large in these negotiations for however long they last.
I'm glad you brought Pete Walker's name up, because as we sit and talk about free agents, players moving from organization to organization, I don't think it's just me, but I think you'd be hard pressed to find a better, more productive pitching coach than Pete Walker. In my mind, he's at the top of the food chain. And if I'm another organization, I'm salivating at the possibility of the opportunity to go and get him. What do you think? What do you think Pete Walker makes? And and why is Pete Walker still with the Toronto Blue Jays? Why aren't we hearing about other teams looking to poach him?
No, it's a great question. I don't know. I'll say I don't know what Pete makes. I don't know when his deal comes up. But it's a very fair question to ask, because the value of a great coach, what we have seen in recent years, a lot of teams that truly understand player development, coaching, internal culture, performance, all of those dynamics point in the direction of hiring the best staff that you can.
Sure.
And interestingly, we just saw the Atlanta Braves win the World Series with what I would describe as a very veteran coaching staff.
Yeah.
And Alex Anthopoulos certainly has understood analytics for a long time. He also has had a deep respect for scouts. And you look at the Braves, the names on that coaching staff: Eddie Perez, Ron Washington, Sal Fasano, Rick Kranitz. These are longtime people who have been around the game for a really, really long time. And Brian Snitker is one of those who, of course, as the manager, has lived that life, managed for so long in the minor leagues. And so I do think that as analytical as the game has become, I actually think that coaching is more important now than ever, because as decisions are driven by the numbers, and a front office says, listen, we look at this pitcher's spin rate, this pitcher's repertoire, which was always true for Robbie Ray, the health, the ability, just that arm that you've been blessed with, the raw materials, if you will, that's the science. That's the raw materials, so to speak, the natural resources, if you will, to use a more of a economics term. But then you have to find a way to make it work, to take that translatable skill onto the field. And that is the art of coaching, the art of, to use the soccer term, man management, the ability to actually translate that into on-field performance. And that is a softer skill that goes with the hard data. And managers and management coaches who understand how to translate the raw numbers and the raw ability to actual actionable on-field performance, those are the coaches who are special. And Pete Walker, in my estimation, based on what I have seen, is a special coach. He got the best out of Ray
and Matz.
And those have been two players who were somewhat enigmatic in the past. I've got to give a lot of credit to Pete Walker.
Well, when the Blue Jays signed both of those players, went and got both of those players, nobody raised a spocky an eyebrow and said, oh, now the Blue Jays are all set. They were a couple of kind of reclamation projects. Guys who had shown some stuff, but couldn't effectively deliver at the major league level what their expectations were. And both now have. And I don't think that's a surprise. I think that's Pete Walker, who knows to say the right things, do the right things. The fact that they're both left-handers may mean something, but it may be completely irrelevant. And you wonder whether how Ray and Matz will look at this, whether they'll accept that, you know, I might be better taking a few less bucks and staying with the Blue Jays where I can succeed, both personally and team-wise, rather than go someplace else where some other pitching coach starts messing around with me and that's the end of it, you know? And I don't know the answer to that.
The one thing that might affect all of that, because I think we've all agree about what Walker seems, he seems to be a bit of a secret weapon for the Jays. But the Barrios contract, don't you think it sets a bar for these guys as well, John?
Sure. It does. And to me, it's the magic number of $20 million a year, because that is what Barrios's free agent years are valued as. It's $20 million. That's a lot of money. And that is a spot, especially when you go times six and you start to climb into the 130 range, as you did for the total value. That's a very compelling contract. And you have to consider again that Barrios got 6 guaranteed free agent years beyond, of course, it was a 7-year deal, but the first year is covered by the arbitration number, what it would have been in 2022. It's a 6-year contract beyond that, again, without entering free agency. Now, he's a young pitcher. He's younger than Ray, obviously, but that just tells you where that free agent value point is. And some teams, many teams actually, will look at which ages that you are buying and value those years accordingly, that paying out Berríos for the next 7 years, you would say, okay, free agent pitcher, whoever you might be, I'll pay you to as many years as we're paying Berríos, but that's not going to be as many years for you as it is for him, right? Because he is younger than you. That is a key part of the way that front offices look at things now.
Do you think the timing of the Berríos signing is indicative of the Blue Jays' thought process on whether they can get Ray or Matz, assuming they're involved in both? And I believe they are.
Sure. There has to be some link there, Bob. I do believe there is a linkage there. They would say, though, if you're the Blue Jays, that he already was on our roster. We believe this is where we're comfortable with the risk going long term. And I also think the agent of the players can then say, listen, we look at your contract. We know where your overall payroll is going in the future. You have Manoah on a controllable contract going forward, and you don't have a lot of long-term pitching liabilities going forward. There's a pretty good payroll management basis, I think, going forward. You consider where Springer's money is, now where Berríos' money is. There's not what I would describe as a ton of long-term liabilities on that balance sheet to where there is room to fit in, I think, a longer-term deal for either Ray or Matz. The question will be, can they afford both along with Berríos? It's a huge question. I think it was important, though, to get Berríos' money taken care of on the books. You know where that price point is. It allows you to then build your rotation around Berríos as opposed to hoping you can build your rotation around Ray. It's a different way of approaching your offseason. I believe the Jays have chosen the proper course.
What about the, we all know what's coming up in the years ahead, not so far ahead. You've got a first baseman and a shortstop who are going to get paid a lot of money. And you assume you want to keep them. Do you sign a pitcher with the understanding that we keep him until we can't afford him and then we trade him? Do you actually sign with that kind of intent? Because we think, okay, Berríos, for example, is going to get paid $133 million, I think it is, or something like that, $131 million over the next 7 years. But he doesn't have a no trade, does he?
There is a limited no trade there for Berríos in that contract. I mean, he is the future of the rotation. He is there.
I give you that. I'm just wondering whether you because we think of the Blue Jays projectedly having a $300 million payroll. Mm-hmm. Like at some point, 3-4 years down the road, maybe. That seems unlikely. But Ryu's contract comes off the books in a couple of years.
Right.
And you do have players you can move. And you do have contracts that you can move. Or can you?
Well, a couple things. Okay, let's take a look positionally around the diamond, if you will. You still have some youth on the infield that you believe could impact your club at the major league level at some point in the next couple of years between Orelvis Martinez and Groshans. Of course, they traded Martin away to get Berríos. You still have Bo, obviously, for several more years before he becomes a free agent. Obviously, he's going to get more expensive as time goes on. Vlad, same situation roughly same service time cohort, if you will. The outfield, you've got Springer long-term. You have Teoscar, obviously, who's very productive, sort of nearing his free agency, but
Bob wants to trade him.
Right. I would not trade him. I think he is Jose Bautista part two in terms of.
I don't want to trade him. What I'm saying is, if I look at the roster and I understand the economic, you can't have Ray, Mats, and everybody. You can't have all these guys at these level of contracts. It just doesn't seem feasible. Right. This organization has never done it. To get to $200 million would be a first for the Toronto Blue Jays.
Right.
And we're now talking $300 million.
If, but that's if you pay.
I get it.
Right. And here's, so here's the really interesting part of all these conversations. And Grichuk is obviously still there. Gurriel is still there.
But those are small contracts, JP.
Well, manageable. So, but
you got one at seven and one at 10.
Right. Can you sign? The question has to come here. Can you sign Ray for a long-term deal and Vlad and Bo? I'm somewhat.
And Semien.
Right. I'm somewhat skeptical that this is all going to work out in that realm.
Me too.
And so here's the really interesting question. At some point in time, and they're never going to say this. I don't think that you actually can do it right now. I'm not suggesting that they will or should, but you start to ask yourself this question. Are you better off if you can't sign Bo long-term, theoretically, could you trade him for pitching and sign one of the other available shortstops who are out there and abundantly there on a more manageable deal? I mean, at some point in time, you have to find who can you sign, who can you trade? And I actually think that there is an argument to make. I'm not saying they should do it, but there's an argument to be made that you should consider moving, especially Bo, middle of the diamond bat, for pitching to then promote from within, and that becomes your cost savings. There has to be a three-dimensional chess approach to this thing.
Agreed.
Because you can't just sign and assume that everybody is the answer forever that's already on your roster, because right. It's simply not going to be the case. The other piece that I'll mention here quickly, all of these decisions would be a lot easier if Nate Pearson had panned out in a way that allowed you to count on him for 200 innings in 2022. And you can't. You can't. Manoah is, candidly, about as good as you were hoping Pearson was going to be. But all of these decisions, and you wonder, what's the value of a great young starting pitcher? If Pearson was turning out to be as good as they had hoped Pearson was going to be, all of these decisions would be a lot easier for the Jays to make.
All right, we got to take a break here, but think about this over the course of this break. Would you trade Bo and then sign Semien to be your shortstop? Think about that one, and we'll take a break and come back after these messages. McCown, Shannon, JP Morosi. Well, before the break, I threw out the scenario. Do you move Bo and move Semien over to shortstop?
It's a great question. And here's why it's such an interesting question and why you have to at least give it some thought is because the number of teams that are right now in the shortstop market, everybody out there in the industry is sort of attuned to this incredible marketplace for shortstops. And the money for a Carlos Correa is going to be so astronomical that when you compare that with Bo, even if the acquisition cost is going to be extremely high, if you were ever going to put Bo out there, it's instantly appealing. Take, for example, a team like the Tigers, just theoretically.
Okay.
I don't expect this is going to happen, but this is a thought exercise. The Tigers are in there for Correa. We know that. AJ Hinch knows him.
Right.
There's that connection, obviously. The price tag for Correa is probably somewhere, at least he wants it to be somewhere in the Lindor range. But even if he
$300 million, probably.
Exactly. Even let's just say for the sake of argument that it's even less than that. Let's say that it's $250 million, the bargain basement price of $250 million.
Yeah, that's right.
Bargain basement price. So let's just work with that number for a second. Let's say the Tigers are thinking, oh my gosh, we're going to have to pay this amount of money to get Carlos Correa. How could we possibly do this? This is so expensive and we can't afford it. All of a sudden the phone rings. It's Ross Atkins. Hey, how about Bo Bichette? Just out of curiosity. What do you think? And then, wow. Okay. but it's going to cost you a Casey Mize or a Matt Manning, one of their top end young pitchers, plus a Riley Green or someone of that nature. I don't think the Tigers would do it, but this is the thought exercise that you have to realize, the tremendous gap between the amount that you'd have to pay to get Correa and whatever Bo Bichette's going to make in arbitration or just in terms of his annual increases every single year. It's astronomical, the difference between the guarantee to Correa and the arbitration steps of Bichette in terms of what the risk is going to be to any individual team. It is a really, really interesting thought exercise. And if you could turn Bo into one, at least one rotation stalwart going forward, plus a high-end position player, you have to at least give it some thought. I don't think the Tigers would necessarily do that. In fact, I'm almost certain they would not trade a Mize and Green for Bo Bichette. But this is where the non-obvious thought process should be considered, especially as we're sorting through all these different CBA negotiations.
Yeah.
This is the three-dimensional chess that a team should be thinking about, even if I would like to say, and John could probably back me up on this too, when you have both fan bases saying, no chance we'd give up Bo for these two prospects, and the Tigers say, no chance I'd give up these two guys to get Bo Bichette. Usually when you say, when fan bases say, no chance, no chance, there's actually some wisdom somewhere in the middle.
Well, John, the one thing I will tell you is that Blue Jay fans right now, their heads are spinning if by you saying Bichette could potentially be considered. I'm not saying trade, but be considered. Sure. Because let's face it, he and Vladdy have been the future here for as long since they've been drafted. And the discussions have been, this is our core, and this is where they're going to be, and they're going to be with us for a long, long time. So anybody to throw it out there, way to go.
It's a fun discussion. And here's the other part of it too. And again, this is speculation on my part, but there is, I think, some historical foundation to consider these ideas. Because the three of us were having conversations, you go back 6 years, 5-6 years, about Josh Donaldson. And remember this very, very well. There was a conversation going in after he was the MVP. I think I said on Bob's show in this exact conversation, they should either sign him or trade him soon. One of the two things. And I remember there was a bit of an uproar, like, how could John suggest this? Well, listen, did the Jays ultimately, let's look back at this. Did they ultimately trade Donaldson too early or too late to maximize value?
I think the answer is too late.
Too late. They traded him too late. And how many World Series did they make while Donaldson was playing for them?
Yeah.
None.
Okay. Yeah. So let's remember this, that at the time, you have to obviously measure what the fan reaction is going to be, but sometimes the tough decision is the right one. I'll make this point quickly. Boston, Mookie Betts. The Red Sox did not make the World Series this year. They did not. But go back and check when they traded Betts to the Dodgers, which obviously helped the Dodgers win a World Series. How many observers probably in Boston said, the Red Sox have traded Mookie Betts to the Dodgers, and how long will it ever be before we see a competitive, compelling Red Sox team ever again? Well, they were in the ALCS this year.
Yeah.
This year. Okay. So let's remember that sometimes you can trade a future Hall of Famer and still find a way to win the very next year.
Well, and I raised the subject of moving Bichette simply because of the economic reality and the fact that you have in Marcus Semien a guy who can be supremely good at either middle infield position. And there aren't many of those out there, JP.
Right. There aren't. And the versatility for Semien is crucial. His leadership is crucial. He was, by any reckoning, the leader of the Toronto Blue Jays.
I agree.
2021. He was the driver of that team. He was the conscience of the room, so to speak. I think the Jays, if they lose him, there will be a palpable absence felt by what he had brought to them as they enter 2022.
Toronto, Seattle, or San Francisco?
for Semien. I think Seattle is where he winds up. I really do. I think he knows the division well. I really believe for Semien, all things being equal, he would rather play on the West Coast. He's from the Bay Area. There's a lot of reasons why Seattle's an incredibly compelling place to play right now. It's an up-and-coming team, up-and-coming city, obviously. I think if I had to guess, it's an educated guess. It is a guess. The place that Semien plays opening day 2022 is the Seattle Mariners.
Does Corey Seager get $300 million?
No, I don't believe he does. He's missed, for me, he's missed too much time with injury to get that amount of money. I do think he finds a way to get more than $200 million. And again, I can't overemphasize this point here. Scott Boras represents both Semien and Seager. Mm-hmm. He knows if you want a shortstop, that road goes through Scott Boras's phone at some point in time. You may not sign one of his players, but you are somewhat obligated to be in his environment, and that will allow Scott to maximize the end result for multiple clients. That also includes Chris Bryant, a Boras client, right, on the offensive side of things.
And before we let you go, you think that the CBA expiration becomes an artificial deadline for all of this?
I think there's going to be a lot of activity, John, between the next 10 days. Now, it's also possible, I would say this with Boras, and I'd watch this very carefully in the next 10 days. With Scott, I suspect that his big-name clients, and I would include Scherzer, Bryant, Semien, that entire group, obviously, and Seager, it's almost, I'm not going to say it's an all or nothing, but I would suspect either you see multiple Boras clients sign before that deadline, or perhaps he waits on all of them until there is greater clarity in the industry.
Oh, we all love when baseball is being played on the field, but those of us who chat about the game probably have more fun at this time of year than any other time of the year. We wish you a happy Thanksgiving, by the way, upcoming.
And we're not even talking Michigan, Ohio State on Saturday.
Need to be a bonus episode of this podcast to discuss that. So I will say a happy Thanksgiving to all. Happy belated Thanksgiving to our Canadian listeners. Happy Thanksgiving this week here in the States. Happy Michigan, Ohio State week. And John, very cleverly done there. I wore this sweater for one of two reasons. It's either a sign of friendship to my great Buckeye friend, Bob McCowan, or perhaps a celebration of Harvard's win over Yale from Saturday. Perhaps both. A sign of friendship, a sign of triumph. I will leave that open to interpretation for our viewers and listeners.
I can't believe we've gone from talking about the Big Ten to Ivy League football.
Now, Harvard versus Yale, really?
It is the game. It is the game.
For the smart people.
It was won by the righteous gentleman from Harvard this time around.
Well, I hope you get that victory to celebrate, because you know you're going to be in a manic depressive mode on Saturday when the Buckeyes destroy Michigan. Probably by a score worse than what they beat Michigan State.
Goodness gracious. That was quite a trouncing of my father's alma mater there, Michigan State. So
48 donut at halftime. Huh?
Sorry, Dad. Sorry, Dad. That was a rough one.
Morosi, we know you got to go. We love you, Chicky baby. Happy Thanksgiving, and we'll talk to you soon.
Have a great Thursday.
Thanks so much. And the Lions, maybe the Lions will win. Miracle of miracles. We'll see if it's a Thanksgiving miracle this year.
Oh, stop it.
Thanks, gentlemen. I'll always enjoy the conversation. Thanks.
The break, and we'll be back after these messages. And we're back. McCowan, Shannon, our thanks to Morosi, as always, for joining us.
Hey, Bob, how much do you think, I think in the new CBA, it certainly sounds like the designated hitter will move to the National League as well.
Yeah.
How much do you think that'll affect what teams do in the National League, if at all? I don't know.
Oh, I think a lot.
Yeah.
Because, but it may take some time.
Right. Well, but free agency, it's starting, but it won't end until baseball starts playing, right?
Well, you must remember when the DH first came into the American League, who were the DHs?
Old veteran guys that couldn't run anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly
Tony right. Oliva is the guy that comes to mind for me.
That's exactly what it was. But that's not the case anymore. The DH is used in a variety of ways these days. Fourth outfielder, Blue Jays.
Fourth outfielder?
Well, the Blue Jays used all kinds of people at DH.
Yeah.
And they used the position to give rest to players.
Right.
Like Vladdy got days off at first base,
but still
DH'd.
Yeah.
And so I suspect that a lot of that will come into play with the National League. And if you're looking for a specific DH, and most National League teams don't have that guy, it probably will take you a while to find one. That's my sense on it.
Yeah.
It'll probably take 2 to 3 years to find one. So you're just going to have somebody else hit, whoever it might be. I mean, there are very few candidates for that in the National League right now.
No, I know. It's with everything that's going on, you have to wonder, the market's going to be different for that position, I think, when you add 16 more teams going after them, right?
Yeah. And I mean, it'd be an interesting statistic, and I don't know the answer to it. Like, how many full-time DHs are there out there right now? Used to be every team had a DH.
Right.
Every team.
Yeah.
Now?
Yeah.
I mean, Blue Jays don't have one.
Yeah.
They don't have a guy.
No,
you're right. And don't project to have one, because they haven't got an old guy or a guy who's a complete stone finger in the field who hits well enough to be that guy.
Yeah. Hey, as much as it pains me.
Yes.
I have to give you some credit.
Okay, what'd I do?
First of all, you told us that the Colts were going to be that good against Buffalo.
And they were.
Holy smokes. If I'm a Bills fan, I'm nervous now. And the problem was the Colts lost two overtime games early in the season. But had they won those two overtime games, rather than being, what is it?
They'd be an 8-5 in a row, I think.
That's right. And they'd be 8-3, and they'd be right on Tennessee's tail, who lost to Houston yesterday. Crazy. And the other one is, when we sat around with the guys, I think Schwirsky and Devlin, is that you picked the Golden State Warriors as the team to come out of the NBA championship. And holy smokes, have they become, or have they been reborn again? And this is without Klay Thompson, really. So they look very, very good.
I thought the definitive difference, and you know me, I'm kind of old school, but the definitive difference in watching that game, the way the Raptors offense works versus the way the Golden State Warriors offense works. Now, Golden State has a bunch of guys who can shoot threes, and they hardly could miss. And that's very
true. Nothing new for them.
But they have guys, they have movement in their offense. There's nobody stationary for long periods of time.
Right.
Guys are cutting through the middle. They have a presence in the post. There's cuts, there's screens, there's ball movement until they find the open shot. Raptors have not done that. There's a lot of one-on-one basketball going on out there. There is very little movement through the middle of the offense. And not to be critical of Nick Nurse, but this must be the way he thinks they should play. And maybe it's the way they have to play. But the difference in the athleticism of the Golden State Warriors and the Toronto Raptors was in evidence last night.
Mm-hmm.
And it was definitive. And it was the difference. And they weren't in it at any point.
No.
The Toronto Maple Leafs on the weekend lose 2-0 to Pittsburgh. Hard to understand why Pittsburgh is their nemesis.
Yeah.
But then go into Long Island and beat the Islanders, who, granted,
COVID-riddled.
Yeah, are struggling.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, and Wall gets a shutout. Good for him.
Yeah, that's a good story.
And now you start scratching your head saying, well, when Mrazek is healthy, what do you do?
Yeah. Well, except Wall needs
We know the what they're going to do.
Wall needs the time still. I mean,
Wall's going to go down to the minors. We know what they're going to do, but is that Wall the right decision? The
yeah. Oh, of course it is. Because you're always dealing in the long term, not the short term. And Mrazek can do the short term, and Wall can continue to grow his game. The one thing that, you know, you have to give credit to the Maple Leafs is when they were in that swoon at the beginning of the year, We were rolling our eyes at all of these, you know, second level free agents they were signing, including Andre Kasha and Camp from who came out of Chicago. Both guys have become quality hockey players for this club and have provided depth scoring where we didn't think this team had depth scoring. And that's, I think that's, other than the play of Jack Campbell, that's the biggest difference in this hockey club. They're finally getting depth scoring. And that's what every good team has.
Well, and they bounce a lot around their wingers. Richie doesn't seem to have a home.
Well, I think he finally found one. It's funny. I was talking to somebody on the weekend. I think he's found some home on that third line. I think, and I think they tried to experiment with his size because they thought that there was some level of physical nature that top line needed, but quite frankly, I just don't think he has it in him. I'm not sure he's smart enough to play there, but he's certainly smart enough to play on that third line.
I'll tell you, the interesting thing with the Toronto Maple Leafs is this is a team that was built to outscore you. And they're as good a defensive team as there is in the National Hockey League right now. I don't know whether it's sustainable, but they just don't give up a lot, do they?
No, they don't. I feel bad for the Islanders. They have a 13-game road trip to start the season and now have opened with two consecutive losses at home in their brand new building.
Yeah, too bad.
Hard to feel sorry for Lou, but I do every once in a while.
Oh, we love Lou. And I do feel sorry for him, but that's the way the cookie crumbles. If you want to win, play better. It's as simple as that. We got to get out of here. Have yourself a swell day, and we'll be back tomorrow for John Shannon, Bob McCallum. Goodbye, everybody.